Hello, this is Matthew Donahue with articles from Archaeology and National Geographic History magazines for the Talking Information Center. Roman Engineers, the Great Builders of Antiquity. Rome's expansion was driven by ingenious developments in construction materials and techniques. Some of the bridges, aqueducts, and ports that once connected the Roman world still stand proud. By Elena Castillo. The Roman world was bound to the capital by the invisible web of law and custom, and a tangible network of roads, aqueducts, sewers, and ports. This spectacle of infrastructure, whose ruins still provoke awe, proclaimed Rome's preeminence across Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. Engineering was one of Rome's most lasting legacies. Adopting technologies already invented by the Greeks, Etruscans, Egyptians, and Babylonians, the Romans refined them with their own utilitarian spirit. Utility, or utilitas, was central to Roman thinking. Vitruvius, the 1st century BC Roman engineer, architect, and theorist, reflected on his admiration for the mathematicians and engineers on whom Roman greatness was built. Quote, "Men whose researches are an everlasting possession, not only for the improvement of character, but also for general utility." End quote. The 1st century AD historian Tacitus once wrote about two engineers who designed a canal more than 100 miles long for Emperor Nero to link the Bay of Baiae near Naples to the Tiber River. The canal was never built, but Tacitus's words express the reverence with which Romans regarded engineers. Quote, "The architects and engineers were Severus and Celer, who had the ingenuity and the courage to try the force of art against even the veto of nature." End quote. The secret to Rome's infrastructure triumphs lay in putting centuries-old discoveries in mathematics, physics, and chemistry to practical use. The laws of hydraulics, the practical application of fluid mechanics, and hydrodynamics, the science of fluids in motion, for example, was largely defined by Archimedes in the 3rd century BC, and put into practice when the Romans began building cisterns, aqueducts, and ports. Advances in topography and map-making from Egypt, Greece, and Etruria were the basis for the Roman system of surveying, known as centuriation, the first step in building their roads and other infrastructure. Rome was the first power to implement large-scale civil, mechanical, and military engineering across all its territory. Many of these constructions remained in use for centuries or even millennia, and some Roman roads, aqueducts, bridges, and ports are still used to this day. Their amphitheaters, circuses, and basilicas also still rise above modern streets across Europe. The longevity of these monuments comes from the Romans' unwavering commitment to quality, no shortcuts, always using the best materials, and precise craftsmanship. Every detail mattered. Many of the most recognizable and durable Roman structures are related to transportation. The empire's territorial expansion relied on a robust network of roads to ensure its political and cultural cohesion. At its peak, during the early 2nd century AD, Rome came to rule around one-fifth to one-quarter of the world's population, across more than 2 million square miles, connected by 200,000 miles of roads, of which over 53,000 were paved. When Roman engineers designed these roads, Their priority was to ensure smooth travel for wheeled transport, and routes were carefully chosen. They had to resort to different solutions based on the relief of the terrain. When crossing mountain ranges, they always opted for the most accessible side, the lowest hill, and the sunniest slope. The least steep gradient was chosen, and water was avoided at all costs. Despite these methods, they still faced many challenges. Flat or undulating areas were the easiest to cross. Irregularities in the terrain were usually smoothed with embankments. Adding materials from quarries created various strata under the road surface, which is why roads were also called strata, a term that gave rise to strada in Italian and street in English. In other stretches, the land had to be excavated to build the road. On the Appian Way at Terracina, workers famously cut through 120 feet of rock, a feat still marked by an ancient inscription. Water posed the biggest challenge, threatening the stability and durability of the infrastructure. With a lake or swamp, the problem could be easily solved by draining large areas with ditches or drainage channels. The small structures or pipes would be unseen by travelers. Rivers required bridges, often the most difficult and resource-intensive structures to build. Bridges became one of the great symbols of Roman civilization, but they are also among those that have proven least able to withstand the passage of time. The percentage of stone bridges from the Roman period that have survived to this day is minimal. Most succumbed to natural disasters, such as floods and earthquakes, fell into disrepair with the collapse of Roman authority, or were dismantled over centuries as convenient quarries for newer buildings. However, a small number did endure, thanks to a combination of their location, construction quality, and continued use. Bridges like the 2nd century AD Alcantara Bridge in southwestern Spain, and the 1st century BC Pont Saint Martin in northern Italy, were built in geologically stable areas, away from the most destructive river currents. Their massive stone arches were expertly engineered to distribute weight and withstand hydraulic pressure. Crucially, many of these bridges remained vital transport links for medieval and early modern communities, which ensured their maintenance. Some, like the 1st century AD Pont du Gard in southern France, were even repurposed and protected by later rulers who recognized their utility or symbolic value. Their survival is as much a result of pragmatic continuity as it is of Roman craftsmanship. Building a bridge posed a dual challenge. First, its foundations had to be secure. Vertical piles had to be driven deep into the riverbed to provide a stable base. Second, the bridge needed to span the entire distance between the two banks with enough strength to support the raised roadway and bear the weight of carts, pack animals, and legions of marching soldiers. Time and again, Roman engineers demonstrated remarkable skill in solving both problems, combining precise structural knowledge with innovative construction techniques. The earliest Roman bridges were made of wood and followed the traditional Greek design, in which horizontal beams were laid across vertical supports to form a post and lintel, or architrave, structure. This simple framework rested on rows of wooden pillars set into the riverbed. In the city of Rome, the earliest known bridge was the Pons Sublicius, which crossed the Tiber River near the Forum Boarium. According to tradition, it was built in the 7th century BC. It got its name, meaning bridge of wooden piles, because of the sublacee, the timber supports lodged into the ground. Over time, the Romans realized that this post and lintel structure was too weak to support carts, marching legions, and other heavy traffic. Wooden bridges, valued for their ease of construction and removal, continued to be used in military contexts to enable the crossing of small numbers of troops. In 55 BC, Julius Caesar's legions built a bridge over the Rhine, an audacious feat of military engineering that was unmatched in the ancient world. Caesar wrote in the Gallic Wars that he, quote, had decided to cross the Rhine, but he deemed it scarcely safe, and ruled it unworthy of his own and the Romans' dignity to cross in boats. And so, although he was confronted with the greatest difficulty in making a bridge, by reason of the breadth, the rapidity, and the depth of the river, he still thought that he must make that effort, or else not take his army across. End quote. In just 10 days, the Romans spanned the wide, fast-moving river, marched across, and then dismantled the entire bridge to deny its use to the enemy. For more flexible crossings, Roman engineers often relied on pontoon bridges. These floating structures used boats placed side by side, with a deck laid across the top, supported by vertical posts. They were quick to assemble, and ideal for wide, flood-prone rivers like the Rhone in modern-day France, where a permanent stone bridge was too costly or even impossible to build. The quintessential Roman bridges were built of stone. Although these bridges weren't a Roman invention, the Romans revolutionized the form with a key innovation, the round arch. This simple yet solid design became the cornerstone of Roman engineering. In an arch, each wedge-shaped stone, or voussoir, transfers its weight to the next, directing the load outward and downward toward the foundations. The central keystone locks the entire structure in place. With fewer support piers needed, arches allowed the Romans to span wide rivers with graceful, durable bridges. The Pont Saint Martin in Italy's Aosta Valley was built near the Roman city of Augusta Praetoria. This single arch bridge stretches just over 100 feet across the riverbed. Its construction was so daring that medieval locals believed it was built by the devil. Other bridges reached even grander scales. Spain's Alcantara Bridge is one of the tallest Roman bridges in the world, at 180 feet high. But it's outmatched in length by the bridge at Augusta Emerita, now Merida, also in Spain, which stretches 2,592 feet across the Guadiana River, with 60 arches still intact. Some of the most ambitious bridges have vanished. Trajan's bridge over the Danube, completed between AD 103 and 105, was a hybrid marvel. Massive stone piers supported timber arches, later replaced by stone, extending a total of 0.5 miles across the river. A carving on Trajan's column commemorates its bold design. The Roman historian Cassius Dio was awestruck, quote, "Trajan constructed a stone bridge for which I cannot sufficiently admire him. Brilliant indeed, as are his other achievements, yet this surpasses them." End quote. Even that bridge was later exceeded in scale. In AD 328, Emperor Constantine commissioned a bridge across the Danube that stretched for 1.5 miles. It lasted only 40 years, but was the longest bridge in antiquity. Still today, with massive advances in structural engineering, it remains among the longest bridges ever built. The Romans made major structural advances in another key component of their transport network, the ports that kept sea trade moving and Rome provisioned. Roman engineers mixed volcanic ash, lime, and seawater into their concrete to create a material that could set hard underwater. This invention was a game changer for structural engineering, enabling the construction and repair of ever more sophisticated aqueducts and seaports. Thanks to the advances in Roman concrete, harbors no longer needed to cling to natural protective features and could expand under the protection of seawalls and piers. Completed by the Emperor Trajan in AD 110, the massive concrete foundations of the port of Centum Cellae, just under 40 miles northwest of Rome, underlie the modern port of Civita Vecchia. The cruise liners and trans-Mediterranean ferries that arrive in the port today, more directly above the massive Trajan-era structures that have endured time and tide for nearly two millennia. Along with ports such as Civita Vecchia, the foundations of many Roman bridges, roads, and aqueducts continue to support modern infrastructure. Together with the physical foundations is the idea of modern states, in which political control depends on technical advances facilitating the movement of goods and troops. Engineering solutions that took roads through previously impassable terrain strengthened Rome's grip over increasingly far-flung territories. By the late Republic, speed on the road was synonymous with power. In the Lives of the Caesars, historian Suetonius describes the remarkable rapidity of Julius Caesar's journeys. Quote, "He covered great distances with incredible speed, making 100 miles a day in a hired carriage, often arriving before the messengers sent to announce his coming." End quote. Years later, according to Pliny the Elder, Tiberius, quote, "completed by carriage the longest 24 hours journey on record when hastening to Germany to his brother Drusus, who was ill. This measured 182 miles. End quote. In her book, The Roads to Rome, which explores how Roman roads have facilitated generations of human interchange, historian Catherine Fletcher writes, quote, "The story of the Roman roads is the story of Europe and its neighbors, told from beneath our feet." End quote. Much of that story lies buried now, overlaid with centuries of history, yet it continues to shape how people move, trade, and connect. World's oldest alphabet discovered in Syria. Clay cylinders offer scholars a new way to investigate the timeline and development of alphabetic symbols. By Anna Thorpe. A 4,400-year-old name etched on a gift tag may be rewriting the history of the alphabet. An archaeological team, led jointly by Johns Hopkins University and the University of Amsterdam, was excavating a tomb in a mortuary complex in El Mara in northern Syria, and stumbled upon a collection of clay cylinders incised with symbols. Experts have recently confirmed this is likely to be alphabetic writing, pushing back the earliest known evidence of this system by half a millennium. El Mara was one of the ancient Near East's oldest cities, strategically located at a crossroads of major trade routes between Mesopotamia and Aleppo. Archaeologist Glenn Schwartz and heritage consultant Hans H. Kervers began excavations at the site in 1994 to better understand the development of Western Syrian societies, which is a relatively under-researched area of study. In the early 2000s, they uncovered an early Bronze Age elite necropolis high above the rest of the site, consisting of 10 mud brick tombs and equine tombs. This was an exceptional find in the region, as there isn't any other example of a whole collection of high-status tombs that were built over a sequence of centuries, Schwartz says. It is very unusual for elite tombs to be preserved as well, as they are usually ransacked by looters. While excavating a better-preserved tomb in 2004, the team discovered 6 skeletons, along with a collection indicating a high level of economic status. Along with finding a huge stash of ceramic, silver, and bronze vessels, then graduate assistant Elaine Sullivan, an Egyptologist, chanced upon some unexpected objects, 4 finger-size clay cylinders. At first, Sullivan believed these were just clumps of dirt. She was about to throw them aside when she realized they were, in fact, artifacts. Taking a closer look, Sullivan and Schwartz noticed they were inscribed with symbols. "That's when the idea that they might be writing first occurred to us," said Schwartz. The writing was unlike anything that had been seen before in Syria. The regional writing system of this era, familiar to scholars, was cuneiform, a wedge-shaped script invented originally in Mesopotamia, then copied by the Syrians and adapted to their own languages. Hoping that experts could weigh in and shed some light on the mysterious symbols, Schwartz decided to publish drawings of the preliminary report in 2006. The report, appearing in the American Journal of Archaeology, initially received no reaction. "I think people didn't know what to make of them either," Schwartz said. He decided to analyze the symbols himself and started comparing them with alphabetical symbols from centuries later from different parts of the Middle East. He noticed similarities. "That's when I got the idea that they might be alphabetic." In 2010, Schwartz published an article in which he suggested the symbols might be writing, and mentioned various possibilities, including the likelihood that they were alphabetic. His suggestions still received little attention. In 2019, Schwartz was invited to a conference in Milan on early writing, and he decided to take the plunge. He tentatively presented the symbols, sending out copies of his conference article to experts. 2 of them were Christopher Ralston, chair of the Classical and Near Eastern Department at George Washington University, and Mada Ritchie, assistant professor of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University in Massachusetts. Both supported his theory. In the 19th century, scholars believed the alphabet originated with the Phoenicians around 1050 BC. Then, in 1905, British Egyptologist William Flinders Petrie discovered proto-Sinaitic inscriptions at Sirabit el-Kadim in the southwestern Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. Subsequent researchers, including American biblical scholar William F. Albright in the 1950s, realized the symbols were Semitic and alphabetic. The dating of the Sinai script to around 1800 BC gave scholars proof of an alphabetic system that predated the Phoenician language. The discovery at el-Mara now suggests that alphabetic writing may have not only emerged 500 years earlier than the Sinai script, but also done so in a different location. "Paradigm-shifting discoveries gain acceptance gradually, not rapidly," Ralston said. He is confident that if more inscriptions are found, preferably longer texts, a solid consensus on the new script will develop. From the Digs and Discoveries section of Archaeology Magazine, Purple Purchasing Power, by Jason Urbanus. Over the past 30 years, excavations at the site of the 17th century colony of Avalon in the Newfoundland town of Fairyland have uncovered tens of thousands of artifacts. These objects have provided valuable information about life in one of the most remote English colonies in North America. Recent investigations unearthed a set of curious objects demonstrating that Avalon's inhabitants had better connections with the greater colonial world than previously thought. While working in a storage room associated with the settlement's main building, known as the Mansion House, archaeologists found 7 tubular wampum beads. Wampum was typically carved from white and purple whelk or quahog shells, and was used by Native American communities for a range of purposes, most commonly as currency. While wampum beads have been found at both European colonial and Native American sites in the northeastern United States, no wampum had ever been found in the Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador. These beads were likely fashioned in the early 1600s. According to archaeologist Barry Galton of Memorial University, they probably made their way to such an unlikely location in the hands of Dutch and New England colonial merchants who had acquired them from indigenous traders. In addition to being the first examples of wampum beads found in Canada's easternmost province, he says, these objects are also a tangible reminder of the many connections between Fairyland's residents and people in other parts of North America. This has been Matthew Donahue with articles from Archaeology and National Geographic History magazines for the Talking Information Center. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.